Support for WPR comes from Becca Kate's Kitchen, Kids and Home in downtown Baraboo, offering gourmet cookware, specialty gadgets, and bridal registry. More at BEKAHKates.com.
Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, this is the toll-free number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our calls, some topics to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about booze and business. Does getting drunk at lunch help you become more creative?
Things have changed in
business.
That's
right. What are the health benefits of having the three martini lunch?
And
we're going to talk about sitting, how sitting too long is not good for your health, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some statistics that show that getting off your dairy air might actually make a difference in your longevity.
Okay. And a good recipe?
My gazpacho. I love gazpacho, especially this time of year, anytime. Time of year, but when the vegetables are fresh, the gazpacho is ready to eat.
This one from the kitchen of Zorba
Pastor.
That's
from my kitchen.
800-462-7413. That's our toll-free number. And let's get to the phones now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Niagara Falls, New York. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I'm a 58-year-old active man, and my doctor tells me I need a hip replacement. But I'm doing research on the internet says that doctors are reluctant to do hip replacements in people under 60 and even more reluctant to do it to people who are very, very active. I would like to get your input on that.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, what happened that you think you may need this hip replacement?
Well, after working a very hard physical job as a delivery driver for over 30 years, I have no cartilage left in my left hip.
Ooh, that is a hard job.
That is.
Take the great big thing out
right.
of it. Haul
right.
it over to
That's right. That's right. That's right. So you did that for 30 years. You're not doing that now? You're doing something else at this time?
No, I'm retired. I'm a minister, but I still do a lot of walking is very painful.
You're a minister, so you've gone from truck driving to ministry? How did that connection happen?
Well, I'm retired from UPS, and now that I have a pension, I'm able to follow my desire to be a full-time minister.
How wonderful is that? How wonderful is that? Well, let's talk a little bit about hip arthritis. First of all, there are a number of things that are factors here. The most important factor happens to be genetics. So some people are prone to that, some people are not. So there are a lot of people who are not in manual jobs who need hip replacement. But a manual job is more likely to wear down a joint. Like you said, using your hip, using your knee can often be a risk factor for that. Previous injuries, football, basketball, anything, an injury, if you fall down on the ski slope, it can all make a big difference. You know, the numbers that you're reading about on the internet, those are really old numbers. We used to say, in fact, I was discussing this the other day in the office, that we always want to put off joint replacement because we have to do revisions. But the reality is the newer joints that have been out for the last 10 years, many of them last 10, 15, 20 years, a very, very long time. And so the real issue when I recommend and I counsel a lot of people on whether or not they should have hip replacement is a function of how much it interferes with their life. So my question to you is, how does this interfere with your daily activity? That's the first question. What does it do?
Well, I do a lot of walking. It's a door-to-door ministry.
So do you have a lot of pain when you walk?
Yes.
Uh-huh. What do you take for the pain? Do you take anti-inflammatories?
Ibuprofen 600 mg.
Okay. And how many times a day do you take it?
Just as needed.
Okay. So you haven't been taking ibuprofen on a regular basis every day?
No.
Okay. So my first step to you, first of all, the x-ray does not determine whether or not you need a hip replacement. There are a lot of people who have terrible looking x-rays and they get by just fine, you know, and there are other people whose x-rays just look like they have sort of mild joint discomfort and they have terrible joint discomfort. So my first recommendation, if you were to come into my office, is I would say, you've got to take an anti-inflammatory on a regular basis and see what that does to your joints. And ibuprofen is just fine and I would recommend 600 milligrams, like you're taking, 600 milligrams three times a day. That's what I would recommend. Now, three times a day turns out to be tough to take a pill. So usually I go to Aleve, generic Aleve, which is naproxen. They come in 220 milligram tablets. That's the only one on the market. And I tell people take two tablets twice a day. Just easier. Breakfast and supper every single day. Do that for 2 months and see what happens. And there are a lot of people that basically reduces inflammation in the joint, reduces pain. And for a lot of people, they don't need to have their hips replaced. And the goal behind a hip replacement is to get it when you need it. And if you don't need it, because you can handle it medically, to put that off. Next question, have you gone to a physical therapist and received any hip exercises?
Not from a physical therapist, but I do a lot of stretching.
You do a lot of stretching. I would recommend one visit to a physical therapist, one or two visits. And the reason is they are professionals. They'll look at the stretching. They'll look at what you're doing. It's just like going to anyone else as a mentor. They'll tell you, gee, you should do that. You should do that. You should walk like this. They'll examine your gait and how you're walking. And that would be excellent. So just sort of to wrap it up, the conservative treatment of osteoarthritis consists of anti-inflammatories to reduce inflammation and then exercises. And then the third thing is a trial of glucosamine chondroitin sulfate. And if you want to know which one to use, I recommend going to either consumerreports.org. You can buy a subscription or you can go to your local library where it's free, or Consumer Labs. Consumer Labs, I think, is dynamite. And Consumer Labs goes through all the different glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate supplements and tells you which ones really have the right amount of medicine in them. And once again, that I would give a trial of a month. So you've got three different things you can manipulate before you need your hips replaced.
All right. I appreciate it very much. You got a great show.
Yeah, thanks. You're calling from Niagara Falls.
Yes.
Didn't a guy just walk across a tightrope across?
Yes.
That wasn't you, was it?
No, but I was watching.
Quite something.
With your hip, you probably don't want to try that.
No, I'll hold off on that.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for your great show.
Thanks. 800-462-7413.
It's very interesting that his first job was a delivery person going from place to place. He's now doing a door-to-door ministry,
yeah.
So he's still using his hips. It's not a desk job.
Right.
And so it's still interfering with his life.
Yeah. But the Bibles aren't that heavy.
The Bibles are not that heavy. They're not light. That's right.
800-462-7413, toll free. A listener now, Zorba in Hartford, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question about a 2.5-year-old. My son and his wife just adopted their second child from China. They've had her in the United States just over a week. Like I said, she's 2.5 years old. And when they got her, she was 16 pounds. She was premature. They knew that. And now that they've been in the United States for just, like I said, over a week, she's gained 9 ounces already. And they took her in for a checkup with their pediatrician. And she's not on the 2-year-old growth chart, so they want to give her some high calories, I guess. And they've suggested whole milk 4 times a day with a splash of heavy cream,
mm-hmm. Okay.
And lots of butter on everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it just, I guess, it just kind of struck me as funny as that would be the prescription, and I was wondering what Dr. Zorba thought.
Well, it does sound funny, but they're right, and I'll tell you why. First of all, you know, we live in a society, I don't know if you've noticed it, but there are overweight people around America. In fact, every time I travel overseas and I come back to Wisconsin, the state that I love, my wonderful state, the first thing I notice when I get to the airport is how we have double bottoms. We have people who look like they're twice as large. Seriously, they're because you have in China, you may have people who weigh 120, 130, and in Wisconsin, we have people who weigh 260, and they may have the same height. And I don't mean it as an insult, but what happens is we now expand our wheelchairs, our seats, and everything else because we have too many calories.
Right.
When you're dealing with a child that has come from an orphanage, and undoubtedly that's where this child was adopted from, and especially if they're off the growth chart, then they're often dealing with some sort of calorie malnutrition. And so what we're looking for is, especially in those first 2 years of life, is the rapid growth spurt. So what the family doc or the pediatrician is recommending is give this child as many calories as you can and let's see what's
happening. That's not an awful lot of dairy?
Not at all. Not at all. all. We know that milk is good. We know that milk is useful. We know that when milk is introduced into societies, that often people achieve a height that is 1 foot higher than previously. And we know the first 2 years of life, it's really calories are really critical. But I think that advice is spot on. It makes sense to me, especially since this child has already started to gain weight. Mm-hmm. This is their second child, did you say?
Yes. Their first one is 9 years old now.
Mm-hmm. And the first one came from an orphanage?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And when she came over, she was about 17 months and actually weighed about the same. So she was like 9 months younger and had the same weight.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And she's grown like a weed. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I expect the same for Molly. So.
Yeah. I think the calories are really a good idea. And once again, it's because we have too many calories in our diet that our view is, hey, we have to stand off on the calories. But that first 2 years, calories, calories, calories.
Dr. Zorba, thank you so much.
My pleasure. And make sure, by the way, that you don't drink all the whole milk that you can and put butter on everything, because we don't want you to grow like a weed.
We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. You say, Zorba, you have a study on drinking at work. We're reminded by the TV series Mad Men that things used to be a little different in the advertising industry, I guess in the broadcasting industry too. A drink at work or at lunchtime was not unusual. So what's this study say?
Well, and let me tell you, that was, if you look at America, that, you know, alcohol in America was a common thing. We drank, the per capita consumption of alcohol in the 1700s was four times what it is today.
Yeah.
In other words, the breakfast of choice for the New Englanders, the drink of choice was rum when they got up. And the same was true until really around the beginning of the 1900s, and Prohibition came and changed it. And in the 60s and 70s and 80s, especially in the Carter administration, they said, wait a minute, you guys are having three martinis and lunch and you're deducting it. That was the issue. You're deducting this booze at lunch. So, you know, the tax code changed. They stopped drinking as much. But this is an article that shows that often people in creative industries like advertising, that a little bit of alcohol might actually help their creativity, that their work output is actually helped by having an alcoholic beverage at lunch.
How did they do this?
What do you think about? Well, I'm, you know, it's one of these pop studies.
And
it was from the famous Journal of Consciousness and Cognition. Now,
you can certainly trust
that's right. Journal of Consciousness and Cognition. A couple of drinks will make workers creative, and they had creative tasks. So I guess some people can do well with that.
So we should reinstitute drinking in business in order to encourage creativity.
Maybe we should expand it from business. What would you think if you came into my office and I had a martini over lunch? You think you would trust my judgment?
I don't think I would be more likely to.
I don't think it would really recommend what I'm doing. I am not going to recommend the three martini lunch. Another junk study hits the garbage.
1-800-462-7413. Toll free, 800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Canadian, Texas. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba. This is thrilling.
Thank you.
Thrill is all ours. How can we help?
My question deals with migraines and monosodium glutamate. I've had migraines for quite a while, and I realized that monosodium glutamate, or MSG, is one of the triggers. You know, you see things that say made from the finest ingredients available.
Mm-hmm.
So why do they need a flavor enhancer?
So you're saying, why is there such a thing as MSG?
Yeah, and how does it affect me? I mean, what does it actually do, and why does it give me headaches?
Sure. Well, first of all, MSG, which we know can have side effects. It's been traditional that we have four things we taste with our tongues: sour, sweet, bitter, and salty. And everything else basically comes through aromas through our nose. We actually don't taste them with our tongue. But there's a theory now that there are receptors that are called umami, which is fullness. And we haven't found these receptors, but there's evidence they may be there. It's hard to test fullness. It's sort of subtle, as you can imagine. And MSG, they believe, triggers these receptors so that MSG, which is commonly put in Asian foods, but not just that, it's put in lots of prepared foods that you buy in the grocery store. They often add MSG, and they will put it right on the label. You go to the grocery store like I do, and you look at TV dinners, although I don't think they're called TV dinners anymore. I think I'm dating myself. There's a lot of MSG in it, and they put it in it because it sells. People like it. They go, oh, it feels like that fried chicken tastes better out of a box, or the linguine that I have on there really tastes like real linguine. And that's why they use it, and it's traditionally used all over China and Asia and still used. And in Tufts University, they came up with an article called Chinese Restaurant Syndrome. And Tufts is right across from Chinatown, and a number of doctors would go there over lunch. Some would get headaches. Some would get nausea, and they wondered if it was the Chinese food, the Chinese restaurant, what they were using, and they discovered it was MSG. Mm-hmm. Now, a number of the double-blind studies have not panned out to show the MSG is nearly as much of a problem as others, but I have a lot of people who say they can tell right away if they have MSG, and it triggers it. I don't know why. Migraines, I get migraines, and migraines are triggered by lots of things, and MSG just triggers your migraines. Is it Chinese food that mostly bothers you, Asian food?
The Chinese food, actually, that was the first time I realized that I was getting headaches, and then I started doing some investigations. But then I realized that Chinese or the MSG is in so many things.
Right. Right.
My friends finally got used to me. I'm always reading labels, automatically, and they would invite me over for a meal, and I say, what's in this? And they say, I put this, this, and this. So then they find me over in the garbage can, pulling all the labels out, reading everything.
The ideal house guest to invite over for dinner. How did you make this? Let me look at the labels and see that. That's just imagine. But you know what? That's the only way you do it. Because if people invite you over and it's got MSG, you can't eat it. I'm sure they've learned to read the labels themselves, right? Before they invite you over.
Yeah, actually, they invite me over to cook. Because of this, I've learned to cook for myself. And so they'll invite me over and say, we'll buy whatever you want. You do the cooking.
Hey, you can come over at our place, too, anytime you want.
I used to buy... Like a pack of cheese crackers before I started work. One day I noticed the label was different. It said new and improved. So I read the ingredients, and the only thing that was different was MSG had been added. And, I didn't think that was an improvement. But I've noticed that it's salad dressings and soup.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dips.
Right, because it sells, it's cheap, it's inexpensive, it hits this receptor in this concept called umami, and the reality is you just have to search for it and search it out. If you're MSG sensitive, that's all you can do. So, well, thank you so much for your call, and thanks for bringing up all this MSG information. I think our listeners really appreciate it. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thanks for all the information. Tom, Dr. Zorba, Godspeed.
Yeah, thank you so much. 800-462-7413, our number. And before we take another break, Zorba, let's share a quick note from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This little tip comes to us from Kathy in Medford, Wisconsin, and deals with fish oil. Not too long ago, we talked about the trouble some people have when trying to swallow the large fish oil capsules. She writes, "Because I have trouble swallowing even medium-sized pills, I've been using lemon-flavored liquid fish oil. It's not too bad as far as taste. I wouldn't say it's delicious, but I first take a spoonful of orange juice, then use the same spoon for the fish oil. The bit of orange juice left on the spoon seems to lessen any unpleasant flavor of the fish oil. I've also used it on a salad with other salad dressing. It was edible at least.
You know, it's something that's, you know, edible at least. So how do we recommend this? You know, it sounds to me like almost like it would be castor oil or something of that nature. I cannot imagine eating the fish oil. But if you can't swallow those big capsules, what you should do is try to get fish oil in smaller capsules. I'm sure they're manufactured. I haven't looked to find out. But you know something? We'll put that on our website, zorbapastor.org, and I'll do some hunting for smaller fish oil capsules. And what some people find easier to swallow is if they put the capsules in the freezer. Yeah. For some reason, a cold capsule sometimes will go down easier. But I think, you know, if you can't tolerate it, putting it something else and trying to disguise the taste if you want to take it is your...
You do think Kathy's suggestion is a good one.
Well, for some people. I myself, I think I wouldn't take fish oil if I couldn't swallow it in a capsule. I like fish, but I don't like the concept of fish oil. But for some like Kathy, hey, it's a good idea.
Have a lifestyle tip you'd like to share? You don't have to spoon feed it to us. Just simply send your advice to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. We have a recipe coming up. No fish oil included in that recipe. Lots more of your calls, of course. Some more interesting research to talk over. And our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. Now, though, before our next call, recipe time, this one from Zorba's Kitchen called Zorba's Gazpacho.
That's right. Well, I'm glad I named it after myself.
Yeah.
But it's but there are lots of different types of gazpacho. Now, did your mother ever make gazpacho?
Good one.
Good one. Good one. Good one. Did my mother ever make gazpacho? Yeah. Good one. And did I ever have gazpacho before I was like, I don't know, 30 or something like that? The answer is no. I mean, it's a traditional soup that is a cold soup that's served in Spain and a bunch of other countries, but it certainly was not traditional in America.
Right.
And I love tomatoes. Do you love tomatoes?
I like tomatoes.
Oh, I love tomatoes. And good tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes taste sweeter often than store-bought tomatoes.
I think I love really good tomatoes, which are really hard to find.
Well, they're hard to find, except during season, and I read a number of articles about this recently. It's heirloom tomatoes that haven't been hybridized that often are sweeter, but it's that ripening on the vine.
Yeah.
It's taking it at just the right time. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And gazpacho is a way to look at what we have in our garden at the farmer's markets that we have around, and how do we make it into something that is delicious. And I often will make a pot of this, keep it in the refrigerator, and we'll eat it for 4 or 5 days, and it's wonderful. It seems to get better as time goes on, and we'll expand it with other veggies, and so this is my gazpacho.
Yes.
My gazpacho. So start out with 2 pounds of red tomatoes, and I would chop them into half-inch pieces. You really want to chop them because you're having them as a soup, so you want them to be small enough so that you can put them in your mouth and you're not going to choke on it. You have to chew it. So that's the idea.
Choking on tomatoes.
It's not a good idea.
2 pounds of red tomatoes chopped into 1 half-inch pieces.
That's right. Good red tomatoes, not junk. Good ones.
Right.
Two red onions chopped. Coarsely chopped. So you don't want them minced, but you don't want a big chop, but you want them to be coarsely chopped.
Got it.
1 green pepper chopped into 1/4-inch pieces.
One green bell pepper chopped into quarter-inch pieces.
And the same for the red bell pepper. One red bell pepper.
One red bell pepper chopped into quarter-inch pieces.
So let me talk a little bit about the peppers, because how you chop them really does make a difference. You can use all green if you want to. I like red. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll throw in a yellow if they're cheap. If they're expensive, I don't do that. But you chop off the ends of them and sort of flatten it out almost like a piece of paper, mm-hmm. and then cut them in slices. So they're slicing lengthwise,
right.
and then cut them again in slices, so you're making little squares.
Yeah.
It looks nicer.
Yeah.
You know, it looks nicer. And then I take the ends and I chop them coarsely. But these little squares visually are a nicer look.
If I got a piece of mm-hmm. red pepper and mm-hmm. a piece of green pepper and mm-hmm. a piece of yellow pepper mm-hmm. and you were blindfolded, uh-huh. could you tell the difference?
Well, the red pepper is sweeter. I don't think you can tell the difference in the short little chop. But can I tell the difference? Yeah, the red peppers taste sweeter to me. The yellows, I don't see a difference between yellow and green.
Yeah.
But the red is a little bit sweeter, I think.
Okay.
Cucumbers. Okay, what you want to do is seed the inside. You slice it in half, take the seeds out, and then chop it up.
A cucumber seeded and diced into quarter-inch pieces.
That's right. Now, if you happen to like your gazpacho a little bit coarser like I do, then what you do is you take that cucumber and you only peel half the cucumber and the other half you have unpeeled. You follow me? So it has a little bit of a bite to it.
Yeah.
A couple of cloves of garlic mm-hmm. minced. A
couple of cloves of garlic minced.
4 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
4 big tea olive oil.
4 tablespoonfuls of red wine vinegar.
4 big tea red wine vinegar.
4 cups of tomato juice, and go for the low sodium so you can determine how much salt you want.
4 cups of tomato juice.
And then we're going to use salt and pepper.
Mm-hmm. S&P.
Okay. So here's what we're going to do. You're going to blend half the vegetables with the tomato juice. Take everything, chop it up, put it in a blender or a food processor and blend in half the vegetables. Then fold in the remaining half vegetables and don't blend them. So in other words, half of them are blended. You've got all these veggies blended in the juice, and the other half are actually sitting within the juice and give you all of the crunch. Then add the garlic, the olive oil, and the vinegar. Stir it up, and then what you do is you put it in the refrigerator if you can and chill it overnight, mm-hmm. and it's absolutely delicious. Now, what we do at our table is we will pass around. We have a little carafe of vinegar because my wife likes to have a little more vinegar, so you can put more vinegar on it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we'll put a little carafe of extra virgin olive oil on there because sometimes a little olive oil on the surface mm-hmm. tastes good. Or we have some truffle oil that we had from France.
Oh, my goodness.
And it is delicious. And I think it's delicious because we take off the container and we put it in the middle of the table.
Doesn't it
and
cost
we remember
like $100 a teaspoon?
No, it was truffle. It was olive oil infused with truffles. It was me spent $100 on a bottle. Me? Please. You've been drinking too many martinis. You had those 3 martinis before the show if you think that's the case. Anyway, it's a great recipe.
Yeah.
It's a great recipe.
Listeners can find it on the web?
Yes. If you'd like a copy of the recipe, come to our website at zorbapastor.org. You will find this recipe. You can search in the archives for some of our other wonderful recipes at zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
+1 800 462 7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
Okay. So first, I want to identify myself as a runner. I run about 45 miles a week, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. Secondly, I'm a vegetarian, so that eliminates a lot of the protein sources that a lot of runners consume regularly. And I guess so a couple things I've been noticing, and I would like to think, perhaps I'm wrong, but I would like to think that being a female runner who's vegetarian is contributing to these symptoms. But what I'm experiencing is, lately it's been a little fatigue, but what I've noticed more in the past 6 months is hair isn't really growing. I'm scraping and bruising very easily, more scraping than bruising, but I'm doing both pretty easily. My nails are brittle. And I'm a single mom of a six-year-old boy, so I'm noticing the symptoms more and more as they grow because we're a lot more rough around each other. But I'm kind of wondering some pointers. So far I've heard iron from people. Make sure you're getting your iron, but I'm thinking if there's anything else, I would love to know.
Yeah, I have a couple of quick questions that really aren't related to your problem. Zorba will help you, but that's a lot of miles. where do you run? Do you run track or do you run a neighborhood or where do you run?
Trails in the woods, on a track sometimes for track workouts, pavement, yeah, kind of everywhere. You name it, I'll run.
Yeah. A second question, you're a single mom with a little kid. Do you carry the kid when you run, or how do you deal with that?
He bikes alongside me, so.
Oh, my goodness. How neat is that?
It is really neat. I love it.
And that's great. I've got some questions. What's your height? What's your weight?
I'm about 5'5". Mm-hmm. I don't really weigh myself, but if I had to guess, I'd say around 130.
Okay. So you're not exceptionally when we look – one of the things we look at with stuff like this is whether or not you're falling off the scale on the BMI side, on the low side. You know, you don't have anorexia or nervosa. That's really, you know, the issue that I was that I was looking at.
But I used to. I recovered about 4 years ago, and for almost 5 years of my life, I struggled with anorexia. And so that's gone now, but now I have these other symptoms that seem almost like when I used to have those symptoms, it was during that time of my life. Mm-hmm. So.
You know, I think it's wonderful that you were able to get through that disease and to be able to control it. That really, I want to just congratulate you on that. That was probably not, I'm sure that was a very difficult journey for you to go on.
It was, and thank you very much for...
Yeah, and that you know, that took work to do. I think one of the things we want to look at in something like this is just global health. You know, bruising is not unusual. You've got a, you know, a young child, like you say, you roughhouse with your child. But then you want to make sure that you're, you know, you're nutritionally correct. Obviously, you're running 45 miles a week. You're doing lots and lots of exercise. That's not an issue, and you're doing that. And as a vegetarian, I think the things you have to look at is, are you getting enough calcium overall? So you're not a vegan. Do you drink dairy? Do you drink milk or have dairy products at all?
You know, and that's the other thing I used to be. I was vegan for about a year and a half, and I noticed some of these symptoms. So I started being like, okay, I bet I need protein. I added some dairy back in. But I still have sort of an aversion to just drinking milk by itself. Uh-huh. I drink soy milk and stuff.
But soy milk is good. It has calcium that's added to it. Yogurt is excellent. You know, a container of yogurt is roughly 300 to 400 milligrams of calcium in a typical container. So a container of yogurt, having some cheese during the day, is going to make a difference, is going to help you. So I would do that. I think dairy really is an excellent source of protein and calcium that's in there. If you're a vegetarian, you're undoubtedly getting enough in terms of micronutrients as long as you have foods that are bright in color. The brighter the foods, the more vitamins, minerals, flavonoids, carotenoids, phytoestrogens, and so on that are going to be in there. And I think those are really the things to look at. On the whole, bruising is really not determined nutritionally if you're getting enough vitamin C, which you're going to be getting through that. So I think I'd look at the calcium. Now, as far as the fatigue, you're running 45 miles a week. What sort of a job do you have?
I am a teacher, so I've had the summer off.
So you've had the summer off. So, you know, I mean, it's a hard work, and you've got a young child. You know, fatigue is sort of common for parents to say. I mean, my wife and I had four kids, and I can remember sort of both of us falling asleep at the dinner table while the kids ran roughshod in the house. You've got a young child. Fatigue comes with the territory. You know, fatigue is a very common thing that people complain about. Sometimes I think fatigue is due to guilt, in all seriousness, that people think they should be doing more than they're really able to do. And so sometimes we have a normal fatigue, which our body is telling us, hey, you need a break. You need a rest. And so my recommendation is, you know, when your son takes a nap, does he ever take a nap?
No.
So maybe that's what you need to institute the 4 o'clock nap before you go back to school to make sure that he's able to do that. But I think calcium is the issue, and then finding a time so you can go to sleep when he goes to sleep, which is
okay,
good.
Okay, so calcium is a big one for you. All right.
I think so. Okay. Sounds like you're doing everything right, and congratulations on getting through that anorexia. That's a biggie.
Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yep. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too.
You too. You know, anorexia is such a serious disease, and the biggest cause of death from anorexia is suicide. It's a huge cause of death. It is a common cause. And to get through that is such a remarkable thing. And then to be able to talk about it is even more remarkable. She's an exceptional person.
Indeed. And before we take another short break, Zorba, let's go through another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Ooh.
Today's email comes to us from Alice in Bozeman, Montana, and deals with coconut oil. She writes, I'm sure many people have contacted you about your statement on the show not to eat coconut oil because tropical oils are bad. I heard what you said and immediately thought, oh no, Dr. Zorba, you've misspoken again. Coconut oil that is not hydrogenated, the good coconut oil, is very good for you. I'm sure you were thinking of the hydrogenated palm and hydrogenated coconut oils that used to be used in processed commercial baked goods like cookies. There is a difference between organic, natural coconut oil and excellent food and the hydrogenated tropical oils. And I'm sure you will see how wrong you were. These are all caps when I do that. To make that statement, she adds, I've been listening to your show for about 20 years.
Oh, gosh.
So
you haven't been on that long?
You haven't chased her away.
I haven't chased her away, even though she disagrees with my stand on tropical oils.
Yeah.
Tropical oils are still, I don't consider to be the ideal oils. So she's right. Hydrogenation is always bad. Any hydrogenation leads to trans fats, and we know trans fats are bad. But I think as far as using tropical oils instead of having olive oil and canola oil is still not the ideal oil. So I'll stand by that, but she's right. She's definitely right. Hydrogenation makes tropical oils worse.
Yeah. She's been listening 20 years. We started the show when we were 15.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. So we're still not even 39 Jack Benny's age.
If you think Zorba's advice is hydrogenated, let us know during our next edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. Just send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. We have some interesting research to talk over. Lots more of your calls. Our medical myth buster, too, right here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 1-800-462-7413. A line is open now for you. We'll be back to the phones. But before that, Zorba, we sit too much, and here's some research talking about it.
Right, right. And we do sit too much. We know that as a society. So this is from the NHANES study, and let me explain a little bit about what that is.
Yeah.
That's a large representative population survey of America, and it's performed every, I think it's every 3 years or every 4 years, and they look at things like height and weight and how much exercise we're getting, how much time we're sitting down.
But this is ridiculous.
No.
Cutting sitting time to under 3 hours a day?
Well, it's actually cutting out 3 hours a day of sitting time. What happens is if we look at what the average person does throughout the day, more than roughly half the day or more you're sitting. You're
right.
Sitting at work.
Right, right.
You're sitting when you're doing this. And they looked at people who sat more and sat less, watching TV, playing video games. Once again, it's part of a national survey. And then they basically looked at how long they were going to live and premature death. And they did some experiments to try to determine. It's not an experimental study, but how much time you actually lose. And basically, if you watch TV less than 2 hours a day, you will extend your life by 2 years. Now, it's kind of a funny number, but it's because we sit around, we watch TV, and we're doing a lot of sedentary activity, which is not what our bodies were designed for.
A lot of people sit to work Yes, they can't. That's part they of it. Can't cut out that.
No, you can't cut that out.
We're sitting for an hour
right here. Well, we could stop that. We could just raise the table and we could stand instead of sitting and get there. I wonder how long that would last. It would probably last for one.
This is really hard to do.
Well, I think it's looking more. I mean, first of all, some people do not have a sedentary job. Now, if I look at my job, I'm sitting down, but then I'm walking between rooms. So when I put a pedometer on me, I'm often at about 9,000 to 10,000 steps
you
a day.
You don't sit a lot.
I'm not just sitting.
Right.
Well, I'm sitting, but I go from chair to chair to chair.
Right.
Sit, stand. That's a difference of one issue. At work, when you're at work, if you find that you're sitting, at lunch, don't sit. Get up and walk. Instead of sitting down at lunch, have a quick lunch, and then walk around the block. That's a way to do it. I think that's really the bottom line of this. The NHANES study shows we sit too much, and it shows that we lose years of life by sitting. So standing up and doing something will extend your life, make you feel better, and you'll probably lose weight because you won't be eating.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413, and Zorba, our next caller, is in Bloomfield, Indiana. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I actually have a rather interesting situation with, shall we say, a relative of mine. It's a bit of an annoyance for him, and it's more of a curiosity for the rest of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, every time this relative eats a meal, right after he finishes, just on the dot, he will start sneezing insanely, like, I don't know, maybe about 10 or 15, sometimes 20 times in a row.
Go away.
And it's very regular. So I was wondering exactly what might be causing it, and if there's anything that can reduce that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. How long has this been going on for?
Started relatively recently, mm-hmm. actually. About, 2 or 3 years ago, something like that.
Uh-huh. So it didn't happen when he was a child, so he wasn't sitting and eating his mm-hmm. Cocoa Puffs and then sneezing 20 times.
No, not to my knowledge, anyway.
Right, got it. Do certain meals tend to cause it more than others?
We being the rest of the family have thought about that.
This is a family issue because no one can stand his sneezing.
Oh, no, it was more of a curiosity to us and a bit annoying to him.
So in other words, this is like somebody talking behind your back.
Yeah.
Hey,
that
sneezes.
George is doing it.
Can't
we put him at a different table or something?
we have thought about any kind of commonality, in terms of the meal. We've eliminated pepper, salt, mm-hmm. any other spices. I mean, there just really doesn't seem to be any kind of regular ingredient involved.
Okay, so no ingredient. Have you looked at coffee and alcohol, by the way? Has that made a difference?
Mm-hmm. That's possible, actually. Mm-hmm. He usually does have, beer before dinner or something like that, maybe a little more. So.
Uh-huh. Maybe a little more than one beer before dinner.
So,
uh-huh. So you want to look at, there's certain things. It's gustatory sneezing, which just means sneezing associated with it. And it can be because of the way we eat and the mm-hmm. vagus nerve. And what happens is the parasympathetic system, we have two systems, sympathetic and parasympathetic, autonomic nervous system, which is really an automatic system that regulates our body, sometimes can be stimulated and causes a sneeze. It's almost like a reflex. And it's from these gustatory hormones that are actually hormones secreted within the gut when we're actually eating, pushing the food down with the gut can actually change neurologically and produce a sneeze. Now, if you'll notice, I've just given you a jargon speech that doesn't explain why it's happening at all. But I sound really good with my explanation.
I was really impressed. I'll tell you.
Tom is concentrating. His pupils are dilated. He's taking every single word in. Thinking, is he going to get to an explanation? Wow, he really knows what he's doing.
Yep.
I'm only explaining the phenomena. But
I actually figured it would be something psychosomatic like that.
But we doctors have learned how to explain things that we don't understand in highfalutin words, so no one questions whether or not we know what we're doing. He's got these silly sneezes afterwards, and I don't know why they occur one way or another. However, For some people, taking an acid reducer such as Zantac, 300 milligrams before a meal, or Prilosec may make a difference. And for some people, alcohol and caffeine may make a difference. But that's about what it is. How'd you like my explanation? Do I get an A for that? An A for effort?
it's interesting because, I mean, but in terms of, I'm actually curious, if I may, very quickly about the timing. Again, it seems right on the dot. He'll finish. Literally finish eating, and then they will start right.
Well, and this fits. Some people sweat while they actually eat, and they have gustatory sweating, and these are because of these internal hormones. But when you call next time, I want to know about your family structure and how this has become a family event.
Yeah, don't ask me.
Well, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you much.
Yep, bye-bye. And Zorba, time now for our medical myth buster. Speaking of sneezing, today's myth deals with the old wives' tale that when you sneeze, your heart actually skips a beat.
No. Not true. Your heart does not skip a beat. But let's talk about what actually happens when you sneeze. So when you're sneezing, you take in a deep breath, right? Uh-huh. You increase the pressure in your chest, and that for a very short period of time, when you have that pressure in your chest, the flow into your heart is a little bit lower. Your blood pressure can drop a little bit. Your pulse can go down, and so people may perceive the pulse actually going down. And when you exhale, your pressure then increases and your heart rate goes up. And that's a very natural thing. When you take a deep breath in and you take a breath out, your pulse will increase and decrease. Yeah. And that is a common thing. It happens in young people more than older people. It's very, very present in athletes. It's not an uncommon thing. And that may be where this really comes from. But your heart actually doesn't really skip a beat. The idea that it skips a beat is not really there. So I would say in this case, the myth is wrong. The myth is a myth.
Yeah. And that's you can see where it would come from because it seems to sort of.
Exactly.
But it's just the pulse rate.
It's the pulse that's actually racing. And as I say, it's a physiological thing. And if you sit quietly, you take a deep breath in and a deep breath out, many, many people can actually perceive that difference. And for some people, especially if the sneeze is a big sneeze and you're going, and you're holding that breath in for a while, it's going to make a difference in that pulse.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to sniff out? Just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, and a Madison, Wisconsin listener with us now. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I'm calling because I am 35 years old and I would like to start a family. And I am taking a medicine called Zoloft or the generic sertraline for depression. And I wanted to know how harmful this was to a fetus and if this is the kind of thing that I can go off of upon finding out I'm pregnant or if it would be better at that point for the pregnancy to just continue on.
Sure. There are a couple of things that are involved here. First of all, there are pregnancy classifications for drugs. And the pregnancy classifications are basically trying to give us a rule of thumb which drugs are harmful and which drugs are not harmful. Mm-hmm. Now, there are not a lot of drugs that have actually been tested to find out whether or not they're safe. But they're drugs that are generally recognized as safe because they've been around for a long time and we've never seen anything that's unsafe. Tylenol being the perfect example of a drug that would be safe. Then there are other drugs that we know are not safe at all. So the drug Accutane, which is used for acne, has a big X on it. You can't get pregnant when you're on it. It does cause birth defects. It is a bad drug, so we stay away from that. Anytime a pregnant woman or a woman who wants to get pregnant takes a drug, she should call her pharmacist and say, what's the category of this drug and is it safe? So I don't have that in front of me for Zoloft. So I'm not going to give you the answer specifically for that drug because I don't remember if it's category X, which is the bad drug, but I don't know where it fits within there. But I do know that your pharmacist will easily be able to answer the question. And I also know that antidepressants are generally safe during pregnancy. There are a lot of women who are on antidepressants, but I don't remember which ones are safe and which ones are not safe. So check it to make sure. Now, what's interesting with the advent of the electronic medical record that I think is really very important is if you're pregnant, not if you're pre-pregnant, it'll be on the screen and I'll immediately get when I want to order the drug, it'll say, hey, this woman is pregnant. This is a category, you know, ABC, whatever it is, or X. You shouldn't give it to this woman. And that's very important. And so I actually have to push a few few buttons to override it and get the prescription. When you're pregnant, I can get that information. When you want to get pregnant, I can't get that information. And some drugs, alcohol being a major drug, it's a drug. I mean, we take it because we get inebriated. We know is worse during the earliest part of pregnancy when you may not even be coming into the doctor to be seen. Now, let me ask you a few questions. Do you take a multivitamin every day?
I do.
Okay. It's important because folic acid, we know, is very important to have on board before you are pregnant because it's really important in the first 2 weeks of pregnancy. It's not really important before you're pregnant, but it's before you know it's pregnant. Do you drink alcohol?
I actually don't.
Okay. Because if you drank alcohol, I would say, you know, when you want to get pregnant, just stay away from it. If it doesn't mean much, just don't drink it or drink very little of it so it's not an issue. Mm-hmm. But specifically for the Zoloft, your pharmacist, your doctor can answer the question too, but the pharmacist is the way to go. You can also go online. If you go online, and we'll put it on our website because I'll look up Zoloft and we'll put it up. If you go to zorbapastor.org, our website, and we'll actually put on the information from Zoloft, and we'll actually put on the information on antidepressants in general. We'll put a link in there. But once again, your doctor, your pharmacist can answer it, and you always want to ask specifically for that drug when you have a baby or you want to have a baby or you're pregnant. You want to be doubly sure, and that means always checking it off that extra spot. So how long have you been trying to get pregnant?
Well, I actually haven't started yet, but mm-hmm. I would like to, and I'm trying to find this information out before.
Oh, you can just find out, as I said. We will put it on the website, and there are antidepressants that are safe. And then,
okay.
And then, of course, if you stop an antidepressant, you want to do it with medical monitoring because there are ways to stop it the right way, and you really want to make sure there's a doc on your side when you're doing it.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. And before we step away for another week, Zorba, let's share a helpful hint from our Facebook page. Facebook fan Suzanne has some advice for one of our former callers. She writes, I was listening to your show today when the lady called in about the runny nose with her massages. Has she considered an allergy to the incenses or oil fragrances? My mom has a terrible time with fragrances. They cause her nose to run and her head to plug up just like a cold. What do you think, Zorba? Has she solved the mucus mystery?
Well, I'm not sure if she solved the mucus mystery, but she makes up a very good point because fragrances can cause probably not a true allergy, but they're a sensitivity.
Yeah.
And I know if I walk into an elevator in a big city where often there are multiple colognes and perfumes on, that if I'm going up, as has happened to me in Chicago, up to the 45th or 50th floor, I'm almost drunk with the smells by the time I actually get into the elevator. So the answer is yes, fragrances can be an issue. Very good point with a runny nose. And in fact, there may be lots of runny noses that are caused by fragrances and smells within the room. So that is a very good point that she brings up.
Okay.
And especially, I'm so glad that she's watching us on Facebook. She might actually like us on Facebook.
Why on Facebook rather than on the radio?
Well, I don't know. It's, you know, because we're in a new century, Tom. You know, radio is the old century. We're in the new century.
Whatever you say. If you have a comment for the show, unscented, please, just send your thoughts along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or head to our Facebook page.
We'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Tom Witter with help from Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0908Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.